Well, Evan, who is Brian today?
Well, so today I think that he might have finally retired from the front lines, although he's definitely still involved. But today, Brian Boyinger is the original trainer for a lot of these really bad neo-Nazi units in Ukraine. We know that he was the guy who trained the Georgian Legion and Right Sector. We know that he was personally involved in the fighting. And I mean, it all kind of started with Iraq with him, just like it did for so many people. You know, like I said, he seemed to be a perfectly normal guy. He joined the army and he got caught up in this unit that was essentially just there to do as many war crimes as they could. That's where he learned everything that he passed on to the units, to Right Sector and all of these guys, who some of these Ukrainian units are so bad that they've even been convicted in Ukrainian court of war crimes. And that's basically impossible. You have to just be brazenly slaughtering people for that to happen. And it has happened with some of Boyinger's friends.
How much do we know about his role in Ukraine in regard, like, was he there just as a mercenary, or is there the tentacles of the American state behind him? We know that there was very prominent American politicians in Ukraine before the Maidan Square uprising. Victoria Nuland, probably the most prominent surviving among them right now. Was he sanctioned to be there, or was this all something he was doing on his own, or do we know?
So we know that he was talking on Twitter, actually. This is one of the few times that he's ever really said much. Usually he's pretty good at keeping things a secret, unlike most of these guys who are just complete meatheads. Boyinger, I think probably owing to his military training, knows when to keep his mouth shut. And so about the only real evidence that we have is that he was on Twitter chatting with Mikael Skillet, who I hope that I pronounced that correctly. It's a Swedish name. But he was one of the founding members of Azov. And we have Boyinger actually just openly chatting on him or chatting at him on Twitter about importing these anti-material cannons into Ukraine. And he says that he already has State Department sanction to do it. Because otherwise, there's no way that you could legally get these weapons into Ukraine. These things are hugely illegal everywhere, even in America. These things are basically a 20-millimeter cannon. You have to have the authorization of the federal government to buy that. And Boyinger obviously had it because he was able to not just buy those things, but he was able to just openly talk on a public forum about importing them into a foreign country with a neo-Nazi terrorist.
Is it a stretch to think that, well, he could have just got these 20 mils cannons into the country without necessarily any government sanction? I mean, because of what we've seen afterwards.
I suppose it's not impossible, but on Twitter, he does specifically say that he has State Department approval. And the fact is that given all of the things that this guy has done and all of the things that his friend has done, the only way that any of this could have really happened would have been if the federal government let it happen. I mean, this is a guy who has an open warrant out for his arrest by the FBI, along with most of the rest of his unit for war crimes. And they just don't do anything. So I think that there's definitely the government is has given him their blessing to do what he likes.
Yeah,
And I think it's nothing new, really.
he's clearly there's somebody behind the scenes protecting him, and by his friend. Are you talking about Craig Lang?
Yeah, I mean Craig Lang in general, but the entire unit in particular, really. Because basically, all of these guys have really all they've done in Ukraine is just massacre people.
Well, can we go to the Maidan now? And you place Boyinger with the Georgian Legion and under Mamuka Mamulashvili, if I'm saying that incorrectly. Forgive me, Mamuka.
I think so.
And they're in the Maidan, and you connect him with the snipers. Now, I've talked on this show to Ivan Kachanovsky, who's done a lot of work on the Maidan, trying to figure out who the snipers were, who they were working for, what their aims were. Can you tell us a little bit about the importance of the sniper operation that went on in the Maidan and what connections Boyinger has to that?
So what happened is, at first when the Maidan was happening, it looked like this whole thing was just kind of going to fizzle out, because a lot of these protest movements do that. Eventually, everybody just gets tired and they go home and the whole thing kind of ends. And it was looking like that was going to happen with the Maidan. So they needed to do something, because they didn't actually have that much support in Ukraine. The Maidan and the people who did the Maidan only ever really had a small sector of Ukrainian society working behind them. And I mean, if you want evidence of that, it's that they had to violently impose their government on all of the rest of Ukraine. So most Ukrainians either didn't care about the Maidan or were against it. So they needed to do something to kind of push them over the hump. And the idea was that they were going to do a false flag attack. And so a bunch of snipers on the 20th of February, they opened fire on the crowds. They were from the it was the Kiev Philharmonic building. And they just opened fire at random into the crowds, basically. They killed both police and protesters. And it was kind of those images of the dead bodies of the people who had been shot. And of course, the media only showed the protesters. They never showed the police that the snipers had shot as well. But the images of these bodies kind of finally pushed people over the edge. And essentially, it gave the Maidan pretext to just start arming and shooting at people. And that was what finally forced Yanukovych, who was elected, by the way, I should say, both the US and the European Union said that Yanukovych was democratically elected. And it was this sniper attack that kind of finally pushed him to resign, which let the Maidan take over.
Well, he fled the country in fear after his own police said that we can't protect you. Okay, imagine that, the president of the United States or the prime minister of Canada being told by the people of charge with protecting them that they can't do it. And so they're his only option if he wanted to live would be to run for his life. He only had a year, Yanukovych, left in his mandate, and he had tried apparently to meet dissent and dissenting opinion in the middle, but there was clearly no appetite for that. The use of snipers, it really struck me at the time because we'd seen it before, and the first time I can remember seeing this sort of the mysterious snipers showing up and shooting it, perhaps randomly, but or perhaps methodically, people on both sides of the issue to in hopes it would appear to throw gasoline on the fire. But the first time I remember seeing it was in Thailand in 2010, the so-called Red Shirt protest, and the Thais there said that these were third hands, they called them, that these were people from outside of the country going into the conflict for what purposes. It seems that they weren't sure even then. Does this, are you aware of the Thailand Red Protest snipers in 2010? And does this strike bear any similarity in your mind if you are?
I'm not really familiar with that, no, but I mean, I know that this sort of thing is nothing new. The US government has been running these sorts of operations all over the world for a very, very long time. And I think at this point, they kind of do just have a set playbook for it, because it keeps working. I mean, we can see kind of the meddling from the U.S. government starting in Ukraine all the way back in 1944. And that's just kind of this direct link between the people who actually did the Maidan and, you know, the U.S. government. But if we want to talk about meddling, honestly, we could even go back to 1918 when the United States invaded the Soviet Union. It's been anywhere from 70 to 90 years that the United States has, well, actually, no, it's been anywhere from 70 to 110 years at this point now that the United States has been openly meddling in the affairs in Ukraine. And we're just supposed to pretend that this never happened and it hasn't affected anything. So it's a pretty convenient thing for them, really. They tend to think that nothing happened prior to 2014. That's usually their line on it. But yeah, I mean, this happens all over the world. I mean, look at what they did in Italy. Look at what they've done in Turkey, you know, South America, Vietnam, Iraq, all of these countries. It's just America. Oh, Libya is another one. Now that the United States of Africa is kind of back in the news, I mean, look at what we did in Libya. We do this all over the world. It's the United States sends in these mercenaries to destabilize countries. We either create a civil war or we just put a government in place that can absolutely loot the country. And that's what we do. That's basically all the CIA does at this point.
Yeah, and it seems if it doesn't work initially, they throw a hand grenade over their shoulder on the way out the door, setting people against each other. Well, yeah. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Evan Reif. He's a freelance writer. His articles appear at covertactionmagazine.com. We're talking around his latest article there, Lord of the Underworld, Meet the Paratrooper from North Carolina, who helped orchestrate the war in Ukraine. When you tie Brian Boehringer to the Maidan and to the sniper attacks and his connection with the Georgian Legion, partly through the work done by Gian Michelesen, an Italian journalist. I'm sorry, Gian, if I'm saying that wrong. And that is discredited. You say that the NATO forces rather try to discredit his reporting by saying, oh, yeah, well, that guy works for a paper owned by Berlusconi. And he was he used to be a member of a neo-fascist party when he was young, the MSI party in Italy. I don't understand why the NATO spokespeople would think that would discredit discredit this guy's information, the fact that he was a neo-Nazi sympathizer and working for a neo-Nazi in Berlusconi. That seems to me to indicate that he would not, he's not somebody that would be working for Vladimir Putin or being a propagandist for Russia.
No. And I mean, these, you know, it's kind of the whole thing where I think these people seriously believe that it's the Francis Fukuyama thing where, like, history ended in 1991. And so just nothing that happened before then matters anymore. And it's all over. And I mean, most people are completely unaware of what the CIA was doing, not just in countries that were unfriendly to the U.S., but in their own allied countries. You know, yeah, Silvio Berlusconi, and we can prove it, it's been proven in Italian court, was a CIA agent. He worked for the CIA. He worked alongside the Mafia and the Vatican for a Masonic lodge that was called Propaganda Due. P2 is what most people call it.
And that was confirmed only after his recent death, too, at least in the press. I mean, people have been talking about it for years. But if I'm right, I just after his death, there was, this is all true, that he was with P2 and they were involved in Operation Gladio, the infamous stay behind terror operation in Europe.
Yeah. I mean, we literally have his membership card from P2. Like, it's this handwritten membership card that they've signed that said that Berlusconi was a member. And so this man was literally a CIA agent, and they did specifically anti-Russian, anti-Soviet work for the CIA. Because, I mean, after the war, the Italian Communist Party was the strongest party in Italy. They were the only people who had really fought against Mussolini. So the CIA had to prevent them from coming to power. And the way that they did that was just by shooting and bombing and killing people and running drugs.
And leaving huge caches of weapons all over the countries that the insiders knew about and could, access to carry out these campaigns you mentioned.
And they found out about this in Italy, but there's always kind of been there's enough that's come out to know that they also did it in other countries, but I think it was only in Italy where they got caught. And so we got these court cases in Italy that kind of had to reveal a lot of stuff. And of course, the CIA officially says no comment on any of this, that, they had nothing to do with it. But yeah, I mean, we know that they were running groups in Belgium. We know that they were running groups in Finland, in Sweden. They had them all over Germany. We know they did other stuff in West Germany. Ursula von der Leyen's father was actually involved in it. And so they had these all over. And it's just really hard to believe that Silvio Berlusconi, who was a CIA agent for 40 years, who fought literally against his own government for the benefit of the United States and the CIA, and then we're going to say, oh, he's pro-Putin. I find that very difficult to believe.
Well,
And the
when you talk about the end of history, Evan, I mean, for Canadians, history never really began. Our media is so curtailed. It must be remembered, and this thanks to Ivan Kachanowski for all the work he's done at the university from the University of Ottawa. But he's written an article, The Hidden Origin of the Escalating Ukraine-Russia Conflict, where he talks about Canadian government support for the those that would violently overthrow the government in the Maidan coup before the fact in the Canadian embassy, sheltering these guys for a week and more before things even happened. So, I mean, Canada, as Canadian, most Canadians don't know, is up to its blowholes in the conspiracy to overthrow this government, overthrow a democratic government, and create this chaos that we see now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Chrystia Freeland's grandfather was literally worked for the Nazis. He worked right alongside Goebbels as a propagandist. And of course, every time everybody mentions that, she just immediately comes out and says it's Russian propaganda.
And that's the official position in the Canadian media still today, that those are Russian talking points. They don't deny it. They say those are Russian talking points. Well, maybe they are, maybe, but the fact is that, yeah, Chomniak, her grandfather, took over a Jewish-owned press that was confiscated by the Nazis and then used it to churn out pro-Nazi propaganda throughout the war years.
Yeah. And then, the important thing is in 1944, kind of once they saw which way the wind was blowing, these Ukrainian nationalists started working for the British and the American government. We know in 1944 that the OUN met with MI6 and started to hash out a deal with them. We know that immediately after the war, the OUN, particularly Mykola Levin, who I believe ended up going to Canada, and again, I probably pronounced his name wrong. I'm going to apologize in advance to any Ukrainians. I'm probably butchering all of their names, but he was a hitman in the post-war DP camps, which were these huge refugee camps for all of these people in Europe who had been displaced by the war. He was an assassin in those camps. He basically killed anyone who had actually seen what the OUN had done to kind of tie up or these loose ends. And he also assassinated communists in these. So, I mean, imagine the type of monster that this man has to be a hitman in a refugee camp. This guy was such a freak that the CIA's code name for him was Devil. And that was the man who would later become, kind of one of the star emigres for the West from Ukraine. Like, go
And a
ahead.
second wave of immigration coming now in during this war too, that's already having an effect on the political discourse in Canada, which is kind of worrisome for people like me. It's funny that you describe him as a monster. My next talking point is about the birth of monsters, and not to stray too far from your article again, Lord of the Underworld, and Brian Boyinger, who is a central figure in it. He was the protege of somebody named in the American military named Colonel Michael Dane Steele. And reading Steele's words, as you have written down some of the things he says in his in a brief bio, he strikes me as like that character in Avatar, the military lead in that film, whose attitude, oh, what was it, Colonel Miles Quaritch in Avatar, the square-headed, brush-cut anti-hero. Tell me about him. Tell me about Steele and what how he works into this story.
Right. So Michael Steele, in a sense, he actually is a movie star because he was in America's intervention in Somalia, which became the subject of Black Hawk Down. And so Michael Steele is actually in Black Hawk Down. Well, as a character in the movie, anyway. So this guy used to be an Army Ranger. He fought alongside, Somalia, which was just a complete disaster. They failed at absolutely everything in there. Just a complete bloodbath. They killed all of these people for no good reason. So when it comes to Iraq, I think that this man, he had just become so warped, I think. He becomes a commander of the 101st Airborne. And what I've been trying to stress to people, because it's so bizarre to me, because it's not that long that we should have forgotten about it. I think that it's just been covered up so well. I mean, what we did in Iraq, it's the same sort of thing that we did in Vietnam. Essentially, none of these people were actually guilty of anything. It was something like 90% of all of the people that we snatched in Iraq had committed no crime at all. They were literally just people that were in the wrong place at the wrong time. But American intelligence or Iraqi intelligence, which was unbelievably corrupt and usually just trying to settle scores and rob people, would say that someone was a terrorist, which, I mean, let's be perfectly clear here. These people were literally fighting against invaders who had come to their homes for no reason and were killing them. And so we call them terrorists, but these people were a resistance movement. They were a resistance to a foreign invasion that had no justification or pretext, because we know, obviously, and we knew from the beginning, Iraq does not have any weapons of mass destruction. Iraq was not connected to 9/11 or Al-Qaeda in any way. In fact, Saddam Hussein hated Al-Qaeda and fought against them. And so we launched this completely unjustifiable, illegal invasion of this country. And then men like Michael Steele are put in charge. And this man, it was like some Heart of Darkness type stuff. Like, this guy was, he was starting up kill boards that they would have in their headquarters, where he would put up pictures of every Iraqi that his unit had killed. And they would bring them back, and he would pose them for pictures and put them up on the board. And he gave out prizes to the soldiers who killed the most Iraqis. And so, I mean, obviously, this led to a situation where these soldiers were completely incentivized to just slaughter everyone. Because
And he was the father, or at least he was a proponent. I'm not sure if it was his invention of what you call, or at least report, the psychological inoculation of combat, mm-hmm. taking his soldiers into morgues and displaying dead bodies and stuff. The idea being that if they were exposed and hardened, inured to death and the blown up bodies and the grotesqueness of battle, that when the actual event presented to themselves, they wouldn't freak out or not be able to perform.
Yeah. He completely, I mean, it's interesting because if he was on the other side, what we would have said is that Michael Steele radicalized all of these men. But because he's in the military, he's on our side, we don't say that about him. But that's really what he did. He radicalized all of these men. Yeah, I mean, he took them to morgues and showed them dead bodies. He orchestrated fistfights and brawls inside of his own unit so that these guys, they were told from day one they were predators, they were carnivores.
He wants to weed out the herbivores.
Yeah, he told these guys that they were there to kill people, incentivized to kill as many as possible.
Well, sorry to step on you there, Evan, but we're fast out of time, and there's no way we can do justice to your article. Again, it's Lord of the Underworld: Meet the Paratroopers from North, the Paratrooper rather, from North Carolina, who helped orchestrate the war in Ukraine. It's up at covertactionmagazine.com. The author is Evan Reif. Evan, there's so much. In preparing to for this discussion, I read The Kill Company by the New Yorker writer Rafi Khachaturian from 2009, where he does a profile of Michael D. Steele, which is quite sympathetic, I thought, but it does provide a counterbalance to yours, which is a little less pitying than Khachaturian was. And we didn't really get to the really effed up angle that you cover in your article with Craig Lang and his buddy Zvi Vellhofer and their cross country murdering spree and you know the creatures that are spawned from, if Michael Steele's intentions were good, some of the outcomes definitely weren't. Thanks a lot, Evan, for coming on and telling us a little bit about the article. And I do hope we get a chance to talk again more fully about some of your other great work over there at CAM.
Yeah, absolutely. I can come back anytime for you.
Super. And thanks to Terry Wolfwood. Remember that the Women in Black will be down on Government Street Saturday, August 5th. At midday for their vigil for the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and all the victims of war, the many, many wars since. Thanks again, Evan, eh?
Yeah, thanks for having me.
When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favorite uncle that's taken you for walks in the park, ever, that he's really a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio, a century of news every Thursday and Saturday.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Sitting at the computer might not make you feel close to nature, but some internet users are actually helping to plant trees while they search the web. Ruby Au works for a search engine called Ecosia.
We are like any other search engine on the web, and like other search engines, we run on an advertising model. But the difference with us is we put 100% of our profits from ad revenues into tree planting and climate action.
Ecosia reports that since launching in 2009, it has financed the planting of more than 170 million trees worldwide. The trees are planted by local organizations, and each project is tailored to its location. In Uganda, for example, the company supported the development of wildlife corridors for chimpanzees. In Morocco, Ecosia helped plant fruit trees that can provide income for local communities. The company also funds urban forestry projects in cities like New York and Los Angeles. Ao says Ecosia has more than 20 million users, and every time someone visits the site, they can see a running tally of how many trees their searches have helped to plant.
It is such a simple and easy way to take climate action.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.